This is the old Good Morning Man, Kermit Edney, with program number 165 in a 260 chapter series dealing with the happenings and the people who made things happen over the past 50 years, the WHKP years since 1946. Today, we wrap up a week dealing with unusual notes in politics, tying in with the start of the great political conventions leading to the election of a new president in November. On the lighter side, back in 1952, when Dwight Eisenhower succeeded Harry Truman and was inaugurated January 13, 1953, that had been 28 years since a Republican had occupied the White House, and quite a number of notable local Republicans made plans to go to the nation's capital to see the inaugural parade. Some of those who had announced making the trip included Sheriff McCall, Mr. and Mrs. Ashley Houston, Frank Bully Waldrop, Miss Bertie West, M.D. McDaniel, and many others. Eisenhower had demanded that the parade be kept simple and dignified. But that phrase can mean one thing to one person and something absolutely different to another. One proposal turned down was to have each Republican congressman ride his own elephant. That was vetoed because they couldn't find 269 elephants to ride. They finally settled on three elephants, including one named Miss Burma, whose daily diet consisted of at least a quart of good bonded whiskey. Officials ruled that she'd have to do her drinking in private. Florida citrus growers wanted to throw 60,000 tangerines into the crowd. No way, the officials said. Not safe. Also, a proposal much more dangerous came from the Clark County, Nevada's Mounted Sheriff's Posse. They planned to throw 10,000 real silver dollars into the stands. I mean, the real silver cartwheels. And the safety official said again, no, no, no. Meanwhile, L.B. Ben Prince was saying without equivocation that the man who should be credited with getting the Southern Democrats seated at the 1952 convention was Senator Willis Smith. He had served as mediator to hold back the Southern hotheads and had secured concessions from the Northern liberals to try to hold the middle ground and keep the peace in the 1952 convention. Little did Mr. Prince or anybody else know that the solemn-faced, tall, junior senator from North Carolina was anything but in the best of health. But on June 26th, the 65-year-old Willis Smith was rushed to Bethesda Naval Hospital, and on Tuesday, June 23rd, after suffering a massive heart attack, he died Thursday morning at 4:20. Now, there are many people today that still hold a grudge against Willis Smith's campaign chairman and his administrative assistant, a man who learned more about the Senate and its rules than any other man today, one Jesse Helms. At the death of Governor J. Melville Broughton in 1949, Frank Graham had been pulled from the University of North Carolina, and the intellectual had been appointed to serve out the term until the 1950 elections could be held. At first, it appeared the soft-spoken, professorial-type leftist might go unchallenged, but suddenly formidable opposition appeared in the form of the famous Bob Reynolds and Willis Smith, who had served three terms in the House as well as Speaker of the House. And they, along with the hog farmer who always ran, Oliver Ray Boyd, they'd go against each other for the remainder of the Broughton term. Now, Graham has always been the darling of the liberal academia, and their full support went to him immediately, which was almost enough to carry the nomination. But between the first and second primaries, the Supreme Court announced the end of Jim Crowism on railroad cars, and that gave an emotional weapon that could be used by Reynolds and Smith and Oliver Ray Boyd on the quiet university president, who was being accused on a daily basis of harboring communists, allowing communist bookshops on campus at the university, and so on. In fact, the first political ad I ever handled came from one Richard Allbritton. He had graduated from Hendersonville High School, Wake Forest, and the law school, had passed the bar, and had practiced some law before resuming farming. He pulled out a checkbook and said to me in Freeman's newsstand, just tell me how many spots I need to run to beat that commie Frank Graham, and tell me how much it'll cost. I wrote out some brief copy for him, and he gave to me a check for the proper amount, and I placed the order in motion. And across the state, conservatives and middle-of-the-roaders alike were reacting violently to the possibility of having the liberal Frank Graham continue to serve in the Senate. And he had almost won it on the first ballot. But Smith was entitled to a runoff, and one was scheduled. The supporters of Reynolds and Boyd joined in with the Smith forces, and they soundly thrashed Graham in the runoff. And who was in the midst of this battle directing strategy and traffic? Jesse Helms. Experience that came from the Smith campaign and guiding the Willis-Smith program in the Senate gave Jesse Helms a graduate course experience in Senate rules and how to manage that august body. He is perhaps the shrewdest player in the entire Senate, starting back with Willis Smith in 1949 and 50. There is irony in this victory, however, and that is, though Smith won the runoff easily, he suffered a heart attack in his second year in the Senate and was replaced by another liberal, Alton Lennon, who took the Smith seat July 11, 1953, appointed by William B. Umstead. So when you hear folks criticize Jesse Helms, it may be because he was the strategist that helped elect Willis Smith over the liberal Frank Graham. Or they resent him when he was elected to the Senate as a freshman. He already knew more about the rules and how to get things done than 75% of the sitting senators. But more than anything else, Jesse Helms is real to the people. About 2 weeks after our house burned back in the late 80s, we'd found a little house which would be acceptable for a temporary home while we rebuilt. And about 11 o'clock one night, the phone rang, and it was Jesse. He had just heard about us losing the house, and he was most grieved over this misfortune. And what can I do, Kermit? Occasionally, our friendship as it blossomed throughout the years would cause me to write one of those get-it-off-your-chest type letters. And he'd let it sit for maybe a week, and then the phone would ring, and he'd answer and start kidding about a particularly harsh and unkind thing I'd said about one of our mutual political enemies. And if he doesn't agree with you, you know it. He doesn't pussyfoot. He comes right to the point. He's always telling the seventh child of a seventh child, "Sursum corda, Kermit. You, lucky enough to have been born in Hendersonville, you with a good sense never to leave, you with a job I know you love." "Yes, sir," Jesse will say, "sursum corda. We don't need to move into a very holy exercise to tell us to keep faith, keep looking up as we head into these next 50 years."